Now, on Bloomberg 1200.
I have traveled this country from one end to another, and I come back to Boston, Massachusetts.
The historic startup culture is astounding.
Everybody, do your job.
And together, we're going to make Boston even stronger.
This is the Bloomberg Bay State Business Hour with Tom Maroney and Ann Mostu on Bloomberg 1200 and 94.5 FM HD2.
That's right. This is the Bloomberg Bay State Business Hour from the Bloomberg 1200 studios in Boston. I'm Ann Mostu.
And I'm Tom Maroney, the Boston Bureau Chief. On our program today, the Israeli-Boston connection. We'll talk about that later. Companies there doing business here represent a whopping 4% of the state's total GDP. And we're going to explore how that happened. We'll ask a CEO whose company thrives in Boston. It's home away from home.
That's right. And first, let's do the numbers. Let's see how local businesses did on Wall Street this week. Let's check the Bloomberg Boston Index, which tracks the area's biggest publicly traded companies. It was down this week 2.25%, closing 114.42, down for the second week in a row, Tom.
In the national markets, major markets Bloomberg follows were down. Dow Jones was down about 0.33%. S&P 500 down the same. And the NASDAQ down almost 1%, closing the day at 4,800. Earlier this week, and we want to get to this right away because it was a fascinating session.
This is a very good get for you, Tom.
Yeah,
good job.
Bill Gates was in town to speak to a group of microbiologists. And so we had a chance to spend some time with him. He's really focused on his global health initiative. He talks like, if you listen to this man talk about this, he talks like a scientist. The nomenclature, he's got it all. But we had a chance to ask him about this recent merger, acquisition, really, Microsoft's acquisition of the social media LinkedIn for $26.2 billion. And here's part of what he told Bloomberg's Eric Schatzker.
I certainly think that the value of the two companies combined is greater than the two by themselves. But I love the idea that the market wants us to show that. The company is expert in software and managing those audiences, and it's great that they now have an opportunity to surprise the world and say, oh my God, look, you know, this feed, this professional feed in LinkedIn, that is how I want to learn about my career, my company, my industry, and I'm going back there. If we can make that as, say, valuable as the Facebook feed is in the social world, that's huge value creation, and that'll happen over, you know, a period of years.
Now, Gates is still on the Microsoft board, right, Tom?
He really is, and that's where he his foothold. He talks about management there. He praises the new crew, but you can really tell he has obviously a real vested interest in its success.
Yeah.
So joining us now, our first guest is Peter Brown. He's portfolio manager at Welch & Forbes in Boston. Peter, good to have you with us today.
Welcome.
Thank you, Tom. Thank you, Ann, very much.
We want to get your take, of course, on what we just heard from Bill Gates, this this acquisition. Microsoft acquisition. It's like some other acquisitions, but in a lot of ways, not like other things they've done in the past, right?
No, I don't think it's much like anything they've done in the past. One of the interesting metrics about this acquisition is they're paying $26.2 billion. Of course, 26.2 is like a magic number in Boston, is the marathon distance, but they're paying $196 per share, and that works out to $60 per LinkedIn user. So if you think of this acquisition as having some economic value to Microsoft over time, they're connecting to 433 million users of LinkedIn around the world. And most LinkedIn users are natural users of most Microsoft products.
It's just tough to measure the success of LinkedIn or how much success people are getting from being on it. You know what I mean? It's hard to quantify.
Well, their growth rate has diminished somewhat over the last couple of years from 45 to 35 to 25% per year in earnings. And they're hoping that this synergistic relationship boosts growth in both companies. Now, Microsoft has said that they don't really expect this acquisition to be profitable, meaning accretive to their earnings, until 2019. So they have a couple of years to figure this out before they expect it to really return some good growth.
And Peter Brown, the other point that we should note is that Microsoft does not intend to integrate LinkedIn.
No, they're going to allow current management to stay in place and continue to run the company according to the tradition of success that they've had so far.
Peter Brown is with us from Welch & Forbes. Peter, I know Quickly, you have some thoughts on Brexit and on the nervousness abounding in the markets worldwide.
Well, Brexit, of course, is the British exit from the European Union, and it's been in the works for a number of months in earnest. The vote comes on the 23rd, and they will decide at that point whether or not they're going to stay a member of the European Union. They've been a member for 43 years. They're not a founding member, but they've been a member since 1973. And they're one of the four largest. They're the second largest economy inside of the European Union. They have a GDP of something about $3 trillion. And on a base of $18 trillion or so for the European Union, they're a very meaningful piece of the European Union. The worry, of course, now is their $11 billion contribution annually to the European Union and how much the European Union can do without them, right?
Right.
So I don't know if it would be quite like California deciding to secede, but economically it's an important event.
Hmm. What do you, in the end, what do you think is going to happen here? Any predictions?
Oh, gosh. I mean, the events of this week with the murder of Jo Cox was devastating. And, of course, she was a great proponent of staying in the union. So they've held off on campaigning on that issue. And the bookies are still saying they will remain.
All right. Our guest is Peter Brown at Welch & Forbes. Coming up later in the show, a new survey. One country doing business here in Massachusetts seems to be punching above its weight, Ann Mostu. Its company's growing five times faster than the state average. I'm Tom Moroney, the Boston Bureau Chief, along with Ann Mostu. It's the Bay State Business Hour on 1200 AM and 94.5 FM, HD2.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Bay State Business Hour with Tom Moroney and Ann Mostu on Bloomberg 1200 and 94.5 FM, HD2.
That's right. We're here in the Bloomberg 1200 studios in Boston. I'm Ann Mostu alongside my co-host Tom Moroney. And in studio with us is Alex Goldstein. He's brought Lior Div, a CEO, and we're going to talk to him in a few minutes. But first, we're going to talk to Alex about Israeli companies opening Boston offices and a new report out that shows how many are attracted to the tech and medical startup culture here. So welcome, Alex.
Thank you. So happy to be here.
We all know you as Governor Deval Patrick's former press secretary.
In a former life.
Spokesman, yes, yes.
People don't stop you on the street and say, hey, didn't you?
Never. No, they just say, who's that bald guy?
Who's that bald guy?
But now you've got a couple different hats, but you are on the board of the New England Israel Business Council.
Yep, correct.
So tell us about this report.
So it's really, really exciting. This is actually the third report that we've done. The last one was in 2013, and what we really did was a holistic approach to seeing what is the impact of Israeli-founded companies here in Massachusetts. And we found that, first of all, there's over 200 of them, which is a significant number. But I think what's even more exciting is the jobs and revenue. 9,000 jobs directly related to and employed by Israeli-founded companies, and also over $9 billion in revenue. And that's direct. If you were to expand that to sort of the supplier effect of all the different folks in the chain supporting those companies, we're looking at, you know, $18 billion in revenue and, you know, significantly 27 million jobs. It's really unbelievable. 27,000 jobs, sorry.
Yeah. So why is this Boston-Israel connection so important? We don't talk that much about, we do a little bit here and there about foreign companies and their presence here. Mm-hmm. There's a Swedish Chamber of Commerce. But like, why do you think this is significant?
Well, I think it's really significant because Massachusetts and Israel have a really tremendous amount of synergies. And this is a huge opportunity for the state in terms of economic development. And I think that Israeli entrepreneurs and founders have been attracted here for a number of reasons. I think that we have a very strong VC community and access to capital. We have a tremendous workforce. I mean, our workforce is one of the most talented and educated workforces in the country with great institutions that support that. There's also a favorable time zone here. And there's now a direct flight that began last year. And you put all that together into the pot, and it makes for a really great sales case. And we have done that very effectively. I think, you know, Governor Patrick went on two trade missions during his time in office, and they really did bear fruit. We hear stories all the time of companies who met with Massachusetts officials and made the decision to come here because we made the case in person. And now they've opened up here. They have headquarters, they've added jobs, and they're continuing to grow and thrive.
Tell us what, Alex, tell us what kind of businesses from Israel find it attractive here?
So, you know, usually if you're an Israeli company, you'll hear more from Lior. I'll tell you about his story in a moment. But if you're an Israeli company, you sort of do hit a ceiling at some point with the Israeli market, right? It's not that big a country in terms of population. And so when you make your jump to North America, it really is going to take some work, and you have to figure where can you go and land as you start to grow. And I think the companies we're seeing here are concentrated in a number of industries. We're seeing a lot of it in e-health, a lot of it in biotech, a lot of it in cybersecurity, which is Lior's company from Cybereason. Application development and management, water tech. Also, we have a big water cluster here that's starting to thrive, and companies have found success there. And I think that has sort of been a magnet for those types of companies. And also, I think the general spirit of innovation in here in Massachusetts. Israel is known as the startup nation. And Massachusetts, I think, is the startup state. I mean, we have really started to make a name for ourselves.
Yeah, you know, GE, as you know, is coming to town, and they can probably rattle off the same kind of reasons that Israel finds this place attractive. One of the things that just jumped out at me is that all these companies combined 10% of all venture investments in the Commonwealth from these companies. They're really, as I said in one of the intros, really punching above their weight.
Yeah, absolutely. And one of the other exciting numbers is the percentage of those investments. When you look at the raises that these different Israeli companies have done here, they're getting a tremendous amount of this money from out of state and also from Israel and elsewhere. So we're actually, they're drawing a tremendous amount of capital into Massachusetts. I said 67% of the investments in these Israeli companies as they raise capital are coming from out of state. And that's good news for the entire state, for sure.
Yeah. So we're obviously, Boston and Massachusetts are competing with Silicon Valley and New York. So what are the complaints you may hear from Israeli companies or the hurdles that they're facing to do business here in Massachusetts?
Well, you know, it's we do have sort of a chip on our shoulder. If those of us who have been sort of promoting this relationship over the years, that we actually now feel like we're fighting above our weight with New York and with Silicon Valley, that we have risen to being that type of premier destination. And I think also, you know, we have some little things in our favor, too. We have a cheaper cost of living. We have a really, really vibrant Jewish community here, which is important to some of the folks. And we have a great quality of life. Massachusetts is a great state to be. I think, you know, one of the challenges that I've heard from some of the founders that I've talked to is, you know, is Boston close enough to the actual market I need to be in? So if you are in water tech, perhaps you need to be in California managing, you know, water crises, things like that. And so is Boston close enough to some of the other areas that we didn't cover in terms of the types of companies that are coming?
Let me jump back for a minute.
Yep.
Water tech.
Yep.
Tell me about water tech. What is water tech?
So water tech is basically new technologies that allow us to reuse and treat water better than we have been.
The desalinization?
Desalinization, a perfect example. So one Israeli company that has come here is called Desalitech. They actually came here, they will tell you, because they met Deval Patrick in Israel. They were thinking of where they're going to come to in the United States. And he made the case for Boston. And they were looking at all different types of places and said, okay, we'll come to Boston. And they have a brand new, very top grade reverse osmosis treatment that treats water better and faster and cleaner than any other buddy in the industry. And actually, last year, they did a fun little thing where they teamed up with Harpoon, the local beer company, and took Charles River water and purified it and made a beer out of it, which Charles is called. I wanted to call it the Dirty Water Brew. They called it the Charles River Pale Ale. But you know, these are some of the top innovations in water technology are happening right here in Massachusetts.
Amazing.
Yeah, that's true. Do you find, I know some of these companies are looking to be acquired. Do you think that's the case for Israeli, I mean, a lot of the startups, at least in Boston, do you think that's the case with a lot of them that are founded in Israel?
You know, I'm sure for some of them, and you know, many of them, I would imagine, if they're seeking their exit, may just do it from Israel. If you're going to spend the time and effort to actually come across the ocean and open a brick and mortar headquarters and start building out employees, you're probably looking to grow at least for a while. You know, what the long-term plan is, you know, another recent company, CyberArk, did an IPO last year quite successfully. It was a pretty large IPO for Massachusetts. And so I think they all sort of have different gradations of when they're seeking that. But if you're going to put in the time and effort to come all the way over here and relocate and build out, you're probably going to stick around a while.
Does GE make a difference in this
equation? I think it's a part of a tapestry of you know, recent things that have happened that show that Massachusetts is on the map and is really a gateway for global innovation. You know, it is certainly given everybody who is interested in the innovation ecosystem here some hope that Massachusetts is rising above the rest of the country. And I think we've seen a lot of things that indicate that. Actually, Bloomberg, I think, called Massachusetts the most innovative state in the country. And it's time for us to brag a little bit and to celebrate that, because it's working when we do. Companies are coming here.
So, Alex Goldstein, we appreciate your insights. Coming up, we continue our discussion. One Israeli company, his CEO had a choice of U.S. locations, Silicon Valley, New York, but he chose Boston. Find out why when our discussion continues on the Boston-Israeli connection. This is the Bay State Business Hour. I'm Tom Maroney along with Ann Mostu on Bloomberg 1200 and 94.5 FM HD2.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Bay State Business Hour with Tom Maroney and Ann Mostu on Bloomberg 1200 and 94.5 FM HD2.
That's right. You're listening to the Bloomberg Bay State Business Hour here in our Bloomberg 1200 studios in downtown Boston. And Tom and I right now are joined by our guest, Lior Dief, who is the CEO of Cyber Reason. And we're continuing this conversation about Israeli-based companies starting headquarters or operations here in Boston. Lior, start by telling us your reason for bringing Cyber Reason here.
So after we established the company in 2012, we knew that in order to grow the company, we need to move to the state. Part of it, we decided kind of where to move. And I have a joke to say about it, is we decided that we are going to Silicon Valley and then to San Francisco and then to the Silicon Valley. But after doing the calculation of where is the right place for us to be, in terms of the time differences, the direct flight, the talent pool, we realized that Boston can be the best choice for us as a company in order to grow.
And that turned out to be a correct prediction. I mean, you have 120 people working for you. You know, you started much smaller, right?
Yeah. When we started the company, we were three guys sitting on one of the founder's sofa at his house in Tel Aviv. Today, the company is 120 people. Just in the past year, we added another 60 people to the company. So right now, the company is in a rapid growth. I believe that till the end of this year, we will be 200 people here. So,
and what do you do? What does Cyber Reason do?
So Cyber Reason is in the field of cybersecurity. We know how to identify the adversary in an environment and basically eliminate the attack while it's happening. As probably you know, cybersecurity become a very prominent problem to every organization right now. We're coming with a depth background of military and government from Tel Aviv. And basically we are applying our knowledge with a new system that we've developed that enable big enterprise to protect themselves.
So you're focusing on these big companies.
That's what I was going to ask. Yeah.
So basically our focus is big companies, but not just big companies. Basically, every company that is above 500 people, we can protect them. We have customers like Lockheed Martin, that they are investor in our company, and SoftBank in Japan, that they are investor as well, and many others that I cannot mention their name in the financial district. And you can understand why I cannot share the names.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So how many employees here in Boston do you have?
So right now there is 60 people here. Another 60 in Tel Aviv. This is the R&D center. And we just opened another office in Tokyo, Japan. And we added another 12 people there.
Great. What surprised you the most so far? What surprised you the most about being in Boston or doing business here?
So I joke earlier and I joke again. I said the winter surprises the most.
Yeah, sure.
It was brutal for us in 2014 when we moved to here. Yeah. But what surprised me in a good way is the amount of talented people that exist in the city. The fact that we managed to basically add so many people, so many new hires to the company in a very short manner of time, and most of them working with us and performing phenomenally, that was something that surprised us a lot.
Where do you look for talent? I mean, I'm thinking Harvard, MIT, but you're also looking for experienced people too, right?
So I think that we're looking for everything across the range. The only thing that we're not hiring here is R&D, development people. This is the center in Tel Aviv. But when it's come to marketing, sales, product, everything is here in Boston. So it goes all the way from very seasoned people that can lead a group of people to somebody that just graduated and can join the team as well.
And what are you thinking is ahead for Cyber Reason? What are you hoping for as a company in Massachusetts, but in sort of in the States for your presence here?
So I hope that we will be able to grow faster. Right now, I think that Cyber Reason is one of the most fast-growing company in the cybersecurity space. I believe that right now there is a huge opportunity in the cybersecurity space for somebody to lead and to solve the problem. We already build a technology that can solve the problem. We just announced that we're offering services on top of the product that we are delivering today. So from my point of view, is to be the leader when it comes to cybersecurity. This is the main thing that we are aiming to.
If Boston could do anything differently, we only have a short amount of time here, what would it be?
So I have to share the same joke again to say not having the winter.
So San Francisco does look better sometimes.
Yeah.
It does to all of us, Lior. It does to all of us.
Well, Lior, Dave, we wish you continued success with your company, Cyber Reason. Thank you for joining us today.
Keep us posted.
Thank you very much.
Very good. So coming up, we switch gears completely. And it's something that I've been fascinated by this week in this week's news. Revlon to acquire Elizabeth Arden. These are two aging cosmetic giants, as you probably know better than I do.
I do, Tom.
86 years for one, 106 for another. Can their synergy create rebirth? And we'll talk to an expert here in Boston about the cosmetic industry in general, get his thoughts. And we're going to have something from you a little bit later on a rave new world, I call it. I'm Tom Maroney with Ann Mostu on Bloomberg Radio.
This is the Bloomberg Bay State Business Hour with Tom Maroney and Ann Mostu on Bloomberg 1200 and 94.5 FM HD2.
That's right. You're listening to Bloomberg Radio here in downtown Boston in our Bloomberg 1200 studios. I'm Ann Mostu alongside Tom Maroney. We have a special guest with us, Steve Moore-Morris, former chief marketing officer of Coty, the cosmetics, fragrance, and skincare company that owns many, many brands. Let's start, Steve. First, just summarize your fascinating career. I know you've recently left the company, but tell us about what you did.
Well, I would say it was sort of a happy accident that I ended up in the beauty industry. And I started probably in the mid-80s, and my first job was as a brand manager at Procter & Gamble and CoverGirl Makeup, which was the number one brand in the United States. I knew nothing about makeup, and I was going into marketing. And then lo and behold, here I am, you know, my late 50s, having just finished a long, interesting, and illustrious career in the beauty industry. But it started working on CoverGirl, and I did what most brand managers did, develop products, developed advertising campaigns, worked on formulas. It was quite, I'd say, a mix of creative and business. So I went from the Procter company to L'Oreal in French, where mm-hmm. I spent much of my career in the cosmetics category, skincare category, fragrance category. I worked in New York. Then I was asked by the company to move to the French headquarters in Paris, where I learned French, and I learned that's, I'd say, another level of beauty and the whole sort of French obsession with beauty products and understanding consumers.
I'm so envious of this career. So envious.
It was quite a journey. And then after a long career at L'Oreal, where I actually launched a product line called Laboratoire Garnier, which was a more mass market entry into the beauty category at a lower price than L'Oreal. Then I moved to a company called Yves Rocher, which is one of the leading botanical beauty companies that sold direct to the consumer through mail order, through door-to-door, through e-commerce. And I was actually president of their U.S. and U.K. and Canadian subsidiary. So I ran an actual business unit in charge of profit and loss. And actually, it was a challenge to take a French brand and market it in like Anglo-Saxon markets. So that was a big part of my career. Since I'm 58, so this will be a long CV ride. Then my biggest, I'd say, achievement in the beauty industry was at Coty, where I started in the year 2000. And at the time, it was a small kind of company, which was a conglomeration of recently acquired medium-sized beauty companies. And really, my job was to kind of consolidate all the companies, create a marketing division, centralize marketing, and create a world-class beauty company. So the exciting part of that was in 2000, we were probably, I don't know, $400 million in net revenues with a low EBITDA, way below the industry standards. And when I retired from Coty a year ago, it was close to $5 billion at a 16% EBITDA. So we had a huge, huge growth of the company, which had a lot to do with just pure marketing creativity, growing brands, acquisitions, license deals. in every beauty category you can imagine. So that's sort of a super speedy CV on the air.
That certainly lays the groundwork. Your bona fides are right in order for this next question, because we had an announcement of a fairly big merger this past week. Revlon to acquire Elizabeth Arden for about $419 million. As we were saying before in the program, these are two giant aging cosmetic companies. I guess the hope here, Steve, is that their synergy will give some rebirth to both. How do you see this play out?
Well, I read about it and I said to myself, it's a great, brilliant merger, actually. I think what is going on in the industry is you have very big players like LVMH, Louis Vuitton, Moët Hennessy, and L'Oreal, and Estée Lauder, Shiseido, very big companies, and they have the advantage of scale. And they have the advantage of being able to leverage better fixed cost distribution across their units and better economies of scale and cost of goods, which they could then invest in advertising and digital support. That's sort of the key formula. So my view is Elizabeth Arden is an American staple brand that has really been very strong in fragrances and actually also in prestige skincare. So they have a strength in that category, particularly in the United States. Revlon is, I would say, another example of an older brand with a great heritage, actually a great perceived brand value that specializes in cosmetics. And they are also big in the U.S., but they have a big footprint in Latin America. So what you really see is, I think, a combination of two companies that are completely complementary. So basically, it becomes a company which specializes in fragrances, cosmetic skincare, prestige and mass channels, and also more geographic reach, meaning Asia, Latin America, and North America. So I think it's a great merger.
Yeah, and it seems clear then that most of the products women especially consume are really owned by three or four mega companies. And which sort of leads me to my next question, which is, why then are there so many new brands? Every time I go to CVS or Sephora, and I'm a big Sephora shopper, there are like five or six new kinds of lipstick. And I always think, who are these people who think the world needs another line of makeup?
Well, it's extraordinary. I will say I feel blessed I was in the beauty industry, because it is constantly a self-inventing category. It's all about innovation. So not only are there lots of little companies inventing themselves, even within big companies and big brands, there are 40 to 50 new products launched a year. It is constantly, it's kind of a market where the consumer, the woman particularly, is looking for theater, fantasy, experimentation, new formulas. A lot of what women are looking for are an emotional attachment to a brand, but they're also looking for products with technology. So it's always reinventing itself. Honestly, sometimes you could take the same product, reinvent the concept, reinvent the advertising, use a new type of packaging delivery system, and you have interested consumers. But I will say I liken the beauty industry to the movie industry. So you have, let's say, the big companies that are like the blockbuster sci-fi movies that everyone goes see, and then you have a lot of little brands, we call them indie brands in the beauty industry, which are like independent movies, and consumers are looking for both.
But you know, your comments about fantasy, this get me thinking about something I haven't thought about in a while. I would watch fragrance commercials, and I would turn to my wife and say, what are they selling here? I didn't know it was a fragrance commercial at
yeah,
some point.
Yeah, that's true.
Well, the people are dancing around the beach or, you know, not to...
It's kind of about sex. Basically.
Kind of.
It's either subliminal
sex
or extroverted sex, but it's all about sex and seduction and, you know, at the end of the day, you know, self-empowerment, people feeling sexy, people seducing someone. It's an eternal need, and I think fragrance taps into that need for men and women. And it's interesting. A lot of fragrances have certainly to do with the experience, the olfactory experience of wearing the fragrance. But a lot of it has to do with a psychological relationship they have with the brand.
You may be the first person to be able to explain this to me. So, Steve Moore Morris, I appreciate your time and your comments today.
I have a product for you after the show.
Okay. Great. We need to have you back on to talk about your celebrity fragrance experiences. That sound fabulous. Thank you so much, Steve Moore Morris, former CMO of Coty, on his former life developing perfumes and cosmetics and his new ventures in Boston.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
So we're going to switch gears for a minute. Tom,
yes, ma'am.
What were you doing at 6 a.m. on Tuesday?
I was on a train to work.
Okay.
What were you doing?
Listen to this. At 6 a.m. on Tuesday, I was at the House of Blues on Lansdowne Street in downtown Boston. It was packed for something called Daybreaker. Have you ever heard of it?
I have not heard, but I know we're going to get some more info on this now, right?
We are. We are. So Daybreaker is this growing business. Some would call it a movement. It's a rave starting at 6 a.m. with yoga and live bands and dancing. It's completely sober. People are drinking water and green juice. And it's like group exercise meets a nightclub. And you pay $35. It goes for 3 hours until 9 a.m. And you can come whenever and leave whenever. Most people go straight to work. At least the people I talked to were heading to work.
Aren't you exhausted by the time you get to work?
You know, it depends on how you feel after you exercise. I tend to feel, you know, much more alive after I've exercised, so I'm happy to go to work. But these folks started the business out of New York, and they called it a social experiment, and now they organize monthly events with almost 200,000 participants in 14 major cities all over the world. So they tested the waters last year in Boston, had success. And Chris Culnane, I spoke to, he's one of the local two producers of Daybreaker, and we spoke outside the House of Blues. Here's what he said.
The energy in this space is very, very spiritual and very uplifting, and it's one of the most legendary national venues in the world, and being able to partner with such a powerhouse like the House of Blues is really special. Yeah.
So I also decided to go to this as for, you know, as a business story, but I also wanted to check out the attendance after Orlando and the shooting. And I spoke to one dancer, and her name is Colleen Bradley MacArthur. I thought she had some really interesting things to say.
So I definitely thought about Orlando when I was driving in. I thought, okay, I'm going to a club. You know, this could be. And then I thought, we just can't let people stop us from doing what we want to do, and I wanted to come out and dance this morning, so I wasn't going to let that stop me.
Yeah, so it was just an inspiring and interesting event, and they're going to be monthly now.
You know, that sounds terrific, and I appreciate when you go out there and find new things for us. It sounds like a great idea. I'd be a little tired when I'm going to work, but be that as it may. I'm Tom Maroney, along with my co-host, Ann Mostu. This is the Bloomberg Bay State Business Hour on Bloomberg 1200 and 94.5 FM HD2.